Welcome back once again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. My name is Professor Greg Muller, and I'm the instructor for the course. Well, today's lecture is the unique lecture for the Principles of Environmental Toxicology course. It's the Socrates lecture. This is the Socrates lecture for 2006. Now, in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, one lecture, we actually let the students vote on the topic. The students taking the course, formally enrolled, actually do a balloting. The criteria for the Socrates Award is thus that, in fact, it has to be a chemical or group of chemicals or a situation that has appeared in the news in the past year. We introduced the concept of toxicology, talking about media representations of risk, media representations of things toxic, and sometimes the media acts with a high degree of responsibility, and sometimes they don't. The award for the Socrates lecture actually gets passed and through that in terms of it could be an overhyped situation, or it could be a situation that appeared in terms of clear and present danger. This year's balloting of students formally enrolled in the course was consistent in the theme of global concern, and therefore I have invited Professor Margaret von Braun to do a lecture, Top 10 Most Polluted Areas in the World. Now, why do we call this the Socrates Award? We call it Socrates Award because in 400 BC, the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates, who established the foundations of modern philosophical thinking, actually was one of the more argumentative individuals, challenging the status quo, challenging it to a degree that in fact he was poisoned by having to drink poison hemlock at age 70. He was a public figure, but a critical thinker. We invite you, as a part of the course and the basis of taking this course, to be one of the future critical thinkers that will challenge the status quo with respect to public health, with respect to environmental health. We are very, very thankful that today we have Professor Margaret von Braun to be with us. Margaret and I have been colleagues for going on a decade and a half here at the University of Idaho. She is presently the dean of the Graduate College here at the University of Idaho. But in fact, she started her education getting a bachelor's degree in environmental science at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She actually followed that with some service at EPA and then started a master's degree, which ended her here at the University of Idaho, achieving a master's degree in civil and environmental engineering. She finished that degree at nearby Washington State University with a PhD in civil and environmental engineering as well. Margaret's area of research has been associated with contamination in the environment and remediation and assessment, as well as risk assessment of especially lead in the environment. She is a highly traveled researcher and actually has been brought into consultancies across the globe in terms of international pollution. It was this background that the Blacksmith Institute tapped her for the Technical Advisory Board. A nonprofit, the Blacksmith Institute actually does a annual list of the most polluted areas of the world, tapping on the expertise and advice of experts like Professor von Braun. With that, let me introduce Margaret von Braun, and we're going to change microphones. And thank you so much, Margaret, for being with us today.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, you can tell from my title, it's maybe a bit of a provocative title, and I'm going to give you some caveats. But even just looking at the title, I'd like you to think about how would you go about identifying what are the most polluted places in the world? Not an easy task. But that's kind of what we'll be talking about today. As Greg mentioned, the Blacksmith Institute is a nonprofit, and this year, about in October of this year, they provided this top 10 list of the most polluted places. This is the first time they've done this, and they do plan to do it annually. And if you can make out from the map, it shows the locations of the top 10 places. Five of them are in the former Soviet Union. There are three in Russia, one in the Ukraine, one in Kyrgyzstan. Then there's one in China, one in India, one in Zambia, one in the Dominican Republic, and one in Peru. So they're deliberately somewhat geographically dispersed. They focus on areas of the world that are less developed, and specifically focus on some of the sites that really have not received any attention, but generally have some local advocates who are interested in seeing the cleanup of these sites. The Blacksmith Institute does provide technical assistance and some financial support, especially to local non-governmental organizations or NGOs who are interested in facilitating the cleanup. And oftentimes, those act as seed grants to then access larger pots of money, like perhaps from the World Bank or the Southeast Asia Development Bank, or sources of funds that can bring the large amounts of money that are typically needed for cleanup of really polluted places. Well, again, I hope you've thought a minute about, you know, how would you rank the world's polluted places? And I'll show you a little bit about the approach that the Blacksmith Institute and the Technical Advisory Board took. We used pretty much the logic behind a basic risk assessment process. And I know you've studied aspects of this in this course, identifying what the hazards are, what are the pollutants, how toxic are they, how much exposure is there, how do people access the pollutant, is it through drinking water, through air, through soil, how much do they access, and how many people access it, and then using those concepts to characterize how high the risk is to the population. So that's generally how we figure out how dangerous something is. And the approach that the Technical Advisory Board took was pretty similar. The selection process involved criteria like the size of the affected population, the severity of toxins, whether children were impacted, because they're often a sensitive subpopulation, whether there were clear pathways identified, and whether there was even evidence of health impacts. Now, if you think about places around the world and how you might get this information, it can be pretty overwhelming, and you probably pretty quickly realize that we, planet Earth, are not really prepared to figure out what the 10 most polluted places are. And I want to emphasize that because even though it's the title of the Blacksmith list and it's the title of my talk, we're both quick to admit that this is only one way that such a list might be approached. And really one of the points of the list is how much we don't know about how to go about this sort of a prioritization scheme. So if we then look at the specific process, again, the focus was on developing countries with little access to money. Over 6 years, the Blacksmith Institute accepted over 300 nominations for polluted places. They have an initiative that allows local nonprofit organizations to basically nominate polluted places for potential funding to the Blacksmith Institute. And they had gathered this list of over 300 places, and from that whittled it down to about 35, which the Technical Advisory Board then was asked to rank to come up with the top 10 list. And that's kind of how we went about it. So we basically whittled it down from a big list to a short list using the kinds of criteria that I showed you. We individually scored the sites, then we had meetings and discussed our rankings and figured out some other kinds of factors that we wanted. For example, we didn't want all top 10 sites to be in one country because it really would sort of take away from the fact that polluted places exist all over the world. And some of them might be big, some of them might be small, some of them might be actually what I would consider representative of lots of other kinds of sites in the world. And I'm going to talk about one of those in a minute. So there were lots of challenges. Some of these places, you know, you've maybe barely heard of the country that they're in, much less ever heard of the site. Some of them have been either forgotten or unacknowledged by their own governments. There are lots of challenges about the existence of data and the quality of those data. And as a result of some of that, when we came up with our top 10, we decided not to rank them. That is, there isn't a the most polluted place on the planet, number one. We felt that just being on the list of the top 10 was sufficient without trying to assign a specific ranking to them. The selected sites, then, are in a sense representative of the scope and the scale of the problem. And I think that's really a key point. Unfortunately, there are lots of them. And these are not isolated, they are not unique, but they represent the kinds of problems that we have globally, and they are clearly among the worst that we know about. Here's the list, and if you go to the Blacksmith Institute website, you can get lots of details on all of these sites, but what I want to do in today's lecture is talk about four of them. I'm going to talk about two of them briefly, the Norilsk, Russia site, and the Haina, Dominican Republic site, because they're kind of representative of the scale of differences, I think. And then I'm going to talk a lot about the Rudnaya Pristin site in Russia and the Kabwe, Zambia site in southern Africa, because those are two sites I have visited and I've worked with folks on and I know a lot more about than the other ones. So I thought I'd just share kind of the details about those two sites when we're done. You'll notice Chernobyl is on the list. That's one that you may actually think, wow, you know, having said what she did, why is Chernobyl on the list? Everybody's heard of that. Well, Chernobyl isn't all solved and fixed either, and it's important to remember the scale of that problem and a lot of the financial and technical challenges that are still in existence in the Ukraine, even with such a relatively recent disaster as the Chernobyl accident. So let's start in the site in Norilsk, Russia. This is actually in Siberia. It was a site that we think affects upwards of, you know, nearly 150,000 people. A platinum plant, mills, lots of heavy metal mining, a variety of contaminants. You can see strontium-90 and cesium-137, including some radioactive materials there. The site was actually probably, you know, when you see things like world's largest, you always wonder, well, how did they figure that out? But, you know, based on its production, at least one of the world's largest heavy metals and smelting complexes. This site was actually developed in 1935 as a slave labor camp in Siberia. So it has a long, ugly history. It has been shut to foreigners. It is still considered a closed city in Russia, even post-Soviet, when a lot of the former closed Soviet cities were opened. It is still one where there's high levels of secrecy. So there's not much known about the site, but what is known about the site is not good. The quote here, where the snow is black, the air tastes of sulfur, and the life expectancy for factory workers is 10 years below the Russian average, which in itself is not very high. In terms of documented health issues, we don't know much. I've worked on a number of sites in Russia, and seeing data like high respiratory diseases in children around the area is very common, because it's one of the things that the local health departments track, whether kids show up with asthma or with other respiratory diseases. So that's a pretty common health indicator to find, and it really, to me, says, you know, we're not asking the right questions, or we're not seeing the right data in terms of the contaminants and the kind of worker impacts that might have been seen, or the kind of community health effects that might be seen. So that's why this one ended up on the list. And there, you know, as you saw, five sites in the former Soviet Union. This is one that I wanted to just bring to your attention. Another site, really across the planet from Siberia and a lot warmer, is near the Caribbean. This is in the Dominican Republic. This is a site that affects many fewer people, maybe 85,000 people, you know, still a lot of people. The contamination at this site is associated with an automobile battery recycling plant. And there are car battery recycling plants literally all over the globe. It's nice that we recycle car batteries, but unfortunately, a lot of times we end up doing it where the batteries are cracked open in people's backyard, there's acid problems, and then there's lots of lead problems associated with the material that the batteries are made out of. At this particular site, there have been some health studies that indicated excessive lead levels in area children, I know you've studied lead a little bit in this class, and you should see that a level above 79 micrograms per deciliter is high. 10 micrograms per deciliter is the standard that we look at in the U.S. and mostly worldwide today. In fact, EPA's most recent criteria document for lead is defining 2 micrograms per deciliter as the lowest observable adverse effect level. So everything we learn about lead is it's dangerous. There really doesn't appear to be a safe level. So 79 is a high value. And various other documented health effects have been documented at this particular site. This is a site that I would say is by no means unique. It is one that I would say is representative of lots of battery recycling facilities around the world. Now I want to jump to the ones that I know a whole lot more about. And I've plotted a picture of the world here upside down for a very deliberate reason. And that is, when you travel globally a lot, it changes your perspective so dramatically on everything you're doing, not only your personal life, but your professional life and how you've looked at environmental problems. So I made a trip with my husband around the world a couple of years ago, and we visited this black line is sort of the path of our travels. And I decided I was going to plot it upside down because it really sort of turned my world upside down in wonderful ways. And it's really hard to do because you realize how locked in you are to the sort of standard way that we look at a map of the world. I know many of you are not in Idaho where I am, so you might try to figure out where you are on this sort of upside down view of the world. But what I'm going to do is talk about three places that are all kind of amazingly related. First, I'm going to talk about Idaho. I know you've studied in this class a little bit about the Bunker Hill lead and smelting facility in northern Idaho, and I'm just going to kind of do a little bit of a refresher and put it in context of these other sites. Then we're going to actually travel east over to the Russian Far East, to the Rudnaya Pristin site, which was one of the top 10 that we just looked at. And then we're going to go to southern Africa, to the country of Zambia, and look at a lead smelter in Kabwe. So those are the three sites that I really want to focus on, and two of those are from our top 10 list. The Bunker Hill site, before I get into that one, what I want to do with these three sites is really talk about what does it mean when we talk about international environmental health problems? What are really the problems, and how do we begin to tackle them? What is the role of the developed world in attacking these problems? A big challenge and a big maybe change of perspective in terms of how we do things in the United States. I know you looked at some of the data associated with the Bunker Hill site. The blood lead levels in 1974, right after the fire at the facility, caused most of the children within 2 miles of the smelter to be clinically lead poisoned. And so the average lead levels of 70 micrograms per deciliter, average, that means there's a whole lot of kids that were a lot higher than that. The air levels were high, about over 10 times what current standards are, and the yard and soil dust levels are high. A lot of work went into the Bunker Hill cleanup, and 32 years have gone into the Bunker Hill cleanup. So I want to just kind of page you through some of the activities, and then we'll look at some of the costs associated with this cleanup. The main focus of the cleanup, and I'll tell you why in a minute if you don't remember, was in soil removals, the remediation of public and private areas that had heavy residues of lead deposited from airborne pollution from the smelter over many years. And literally, in somebody's yard, what that meant is we went in and we removed the top layer of contaminated soil, replaced it with clean soil, and then replaced it with sod. So when we say remediation at this site, we're not talking about removing all of the pollutants. That was deemed very early on in the cleanup as being completely infeasible and unaffordable. The contamination is much, much deeper than the amount of contamination, roughly the top foot of soil that we removed and replaced. So it really is a cleanup that provides a barrier technology, if you will. So you're trying to prevent a barrier between accessing the contaminated soils beneath that barrier. And there's a big control program about making sure that that barrier is protected. Another important aspect of the cleanup was the demolition of the industrial complex. The lead smelter was actually demolished, and it was basically put into a landfill, and the town has literally been converted from one that focused around mining and smelting to now being a destination ski resort. So in 30 years, that's a pretty big transition for any community to make, and it's a pretty big transition in terms of all the socioeconomic, community, stability, et cetera, kinds of issues that have to be addressed in order to make that happen. Here's a list of things that have been key to the success. Number one, the community. Families, local non-governmental organizations, community leaders. If you don't have them, it's not going to work in terms of a cleanup, whether it's in Idaho at Bunker Hill or anywhere else in the world. And that's really why that's first on the list. You're doing something to and for a local community, and you have to have their buy-in. You clearly need scientific, technological expertise. This is a risk-based cleanup, so it's identifying what are the pathways of concern, what are the health problems that you're trying to fix, and how can you come up with the engineering remedies that will repair those problems that you've identified. And that's, of course, the key scientific part, is figuring out what are the pathways that you need to sever to make the cleanup happen. You got to do it with economic development. If you clean up a community and you don't leave anything for anybody to do for a living, then you've cleaned up a community and you've basically made it so that it can be successfully abandoned. So you'd like the cleanup to be tied with economic development. And at Bunker Hill, that involved hiring a lot of local people, and it involved doing the remediation in ways that could help them move into their new economic base as a ski resort. Ecological restoration, second after health. These kinds of cleanups in the U.S. are clearly driven by human health as the priority, but the ecological restoration, definitely another big key part of the cleanup. And then look at the huge amounts of money that have been involved. We've spent about $500 million. A lot of that was government money. Some of it came from legal actions against the mining companies under Superfund. And we expect to spend about $350 million more before the cleanup is finalized. So a huge amount of money. And one of the first things you do when you fly to an underdeveloped part of the world and you look at similar problems and you think about how much money we use to clean them up in the United States is you realize that ain't going to work, because there isn't that kind of money in a lot of parts of the world where the problems are quite similar. I want to spend a few moments on pathways, because I said, to do a cleanup well, you've got to understand how human health is being impacted. And at Bunker Hill, we used this diagram, and we use it at lots of other sites too, but at Bunker Hill, we learned which of the pathways brought lead to the child, okay? And it lists all of the choices, all of the possible pathways, and then for each specific site, you identify which ones are really the ones that matter. At Bunker Hill, all of the ones across the top, local produce, drinking water, the U.S. market basket, what you buy at the grocery store, all of the things that go into your diet really didn't matter much. We've taken lead solder out of cans. Drinking water is pretty well regulated. Produce at Bunker Hill, really wasn't a part of subsistence. It was pretty easy in the early years to tell people just not to have gardens until we could remediate their gardens. So it wasn't a huge source. Lead paint wasn't a big issue at Bunker Hill. The other stuff, the yard soil, the house dust, and the other soils and dusts that came from rights of way and other community neighboring soils, represented 80 to 90% of the way a child got lead poisoned. So it was all the stuff on the bottom half of this graph that mattered at this particular site. So we knew, having done this work, to develop that model that said 80 to 90% of the problem is from the soil, that soil cleanup was going to be the biggest point of attention for the cleanup. And that took years to develop. It took everything from behavioral psychologists and medical doctors who studied children's behavior and determined that a two-year-old typically eats 100 milligrams of dirt a day. That's the average child. Some kids eat a lot more dirt than that, just by hand-to-mouth behavior, sticking toys and dropped candy into their mouths and that kind of stuff. And then if we know that they're going to eat that much dirt almost regardless of what you do, and any of you that have had a two-year-old know that, what you want to do is get them to eat clean dirt instead of dirty dirt. And so that's really, in a nutshell, what we did at Bunker Hill, is we replaced the contaminated dirt with clean dirt so that if kids eat dirt, they're at least eating clean dirt. Okay, now we're going to jump across the Pacific Ocean to Rudnaya Pristan. And this was one of the sites off our top 10 list. It actually has a lot of parallels to the Bunker Hill site. It's on the coast of Far East Russia, just north of North Korea, and pretty close to the China border. So it's a very remote part of Russia in terms of, I think it's 10 time zones from Moscow, the other Moscow in Russia. The biggest town close by is Vladivostok, which was a closed city under the Soviet era. It was their naval, the head of the Russian Navy. But it's about 250 miles north of Vladivostok. The smelter was built about the same time as the Bunker Hill smelter. It was actually built by the family of Yul Brynner, who was the Brynner family owned a lot of property in this area of Russia. And Yul Brynner, of course, came to Hollywood to become a movie star, their favorite son. But the family owned the smelter until it was taken over by Soviets and became a nationalized smelter. As you can maybe tell from this picture, when I first visited it about 10 years ago, it was in terrible disrepair. They seldom closed for maintenance. It really hadn't seen much modernization in about 5 or 6 decades. So it was running pretty much like a Soviet-era 1930s smelter. I'm going to take a little aside before I tell you more about the pollution to talk about one of the things that I think is really critical and important to cleanup, to networks, and to careers, and that is serendipity. So this is a slide to remind me to talk about serendipity. The lady in the middle front, Nadezhda Kristoforova, is a professor in Vladivostok at Far East State University, and she had almost the equivalent job to me. So she ran an environmental program there, and I ran one at that time at the University of Idaho. And she was a visiting scholar at Washington State University, just a few miles down the road here, and came over to the University of Idaho one day because my husband and I were giving a lecture about the Bunker Hill site. And she wanted to hear about this lead smelting site in Idaho. And at the end of the lecture, she came up to us and said, you know, there's a place just like this where I work north of Vladivostok. It's so similar, I can't believe it. And we got to talking about it and went out to dinner. And by the end of the dinner, she said, well, if you're ever in Far East Russia, you know, look me up and we'll go visit the site. Well, little did she know that we took that as a very serious invitation. And a year later, we jumped on a plane and we went to visit this site with her. And that's how we first learned about this site, was by making this connection with this person. And she and her colleagues had been working on this site for about 25 years. Again, a lot of parallels to what we had been doing in our careers. I mentioned that the site was built about the same time as the Bunker Hill. A lot of the same pathways of contamination, a lot of the same problems. It is, as you can see here, on the Sea of Japan, so it's on the ocean, which, you know, from a pollution point of view, in terms of human health, you might say was a good thing, because at least about half the time the pollutants were blowing out to sea. Not so good for the marine environment, but at least not impacting people all around it, like at Bunker Hill. But the Soviets' system of science was such that they couldn't really study pollution levels around the plant. And Nadezhda's colleagues, and who became my colleagues, were studying things like the mollusk uptake of heavy metals out in the bay, how much lead pollution fell on oak leaves 10 miles away from the smelter. You know, they were looking at ambient environmental effects pretty far from the smelter. They weren't allowed to study human health effects or closer in environmental effects because it, you know, would have had pretty serious political consequences to try to get those kind of data and then report them. This was a Soviet-owned company. So they had, even though they had a lot of recognition that they weren't able to study all the things that they would have liked to have studied and that they knew other people around the world were studying, they knew enough to be able to extrapolate that this plant was in fact very contaminated. And it wasn't until, you know, much more recently, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, that a lot of those issues could be more openly addressed. This is not quite an aerial picture. I took this actually from a lighthouse. But if you look at the brownish areas towards the middle of the slide, those are all denuded hillsides from sulfur dioxide. The smelter is just about right in the middle of this picture. And you see the little town of Rudnaya Pristan, which is about 5,000 people. The smelter is the primary employer in town, so it is the show in town in terms of employment. There are lead mines and other industrial facilities all up and down this valley, and that's where the impacted population number is quite a bit higher than just this little town because of the mining and other related activities. They've dumped tailings into the river nearby, much as we did in the U.S. for much of the last century until the Clean Water Acts came into the 70s. They dumped their tailings into the river, and the river, you know, like in a lot of communities, becomes a source of play and fishing and everything else. They also transported the concentrates from the mine, which is about 30 miles from Rudnaya Pristan, to the smelter in these little open ore cars. And this is actually one of the sort of worst pathways of pollution, if you will, at this site, because this is lead concentrate. This is, you know, hundreds of 1,000% lead or something. And it's in these little open rail cars, and like in a lot of communities, railroad tracks become sort of surrogate sidewalks. So people are walking along the tracks when the train isn't there, and this concentrate is spilled all along the tracks. There's nothing to keep it from being spilled. You can see it on the side of the track here, and you can see it here in the picture. There's the old tailings were, or the pilings were removed and replaced. And you can see the concentrate on the side of the track. So this stuff literally gets tracked inside people's houses. You know, kids are playing around here, and it's very, very high levels of contaminant. But a relatively easy repair, if you think about it. I mean, if you're going to ship concentrate in rail cars, can we cover the cars? Can we do things to prevent at least the spillage of these concentrates and replace some of the areas that are highly contaminated like this? This is a very similar thing at Bunker Hill. At Bunker Hill, we've done some rails to trails things, and the rail lines also had a lot of spilled materials around them and were actually built on old mine tailings. It's a pretty common problem, and it's one that we know how to fix. As I mentioned, the smelter really rarely was ever shut down for maintenance. It ran pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Last year, they actually shut it down. They decided it was no longer economically viable. But in its day, it was actually the one of the main lead smelters in all of Russia. It manufactured most of the bullets that Russia used in World War II. And after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the other big lead smelters in the Soviet Union were in Kazakhstan. And so this one became a really pretty important one in Russia and ended up becoming a secondary smelter, including reprocessing of batteries from nuclear submarines and from cars and all kinds of other things. This is a picture of the hearth inside the smelter. It was an open hearth furnace. And the guy in the little inset there is driving something that looks sort of like a forklift. He's actually loading the concentrates into the furnace in what I consider one of the worst jobs I've ever seen anybody have because of the levels of contamination. When I took these pictures, it was so dark that I didn't have any dream that these pictures would turn out. I mean, it was like being in a completely darkened room inside the smelter, so the flash actually illuminated what we were looking at better than anything. They didn't run a lot of their ventilation equipment to save on electricity. They really had virtually no worker protection, as I'll show you in a few more slides. And this particular hearth furnace is so old that when we visited this with a guy who's visited lead smelters all over the world, he said, I've never seen one of this. It should be in a museum. It's really ancient technology. So again, you know, not a lot of upgrades in terms of technological improvements. I'll let you look at this picture for a minute and just think about occupational hygiene and worker protection in factories that you may have visited or know about in the U.S. We took a group of college students to do some sampling at the beach and took a detour and got a tour of the smelter. Some of the kids were wearing flip-flops and, you know, beach clothes. And there really was virtually no protection for workers and really very much monitoring of workers at all at this facility. They did produce a pretty high quality product used for car batteries, shipped around the world. The guy here is actually gathering, the molten lead is gathered into these little ingots and then piled into these bricks for transport. Well, I mentioned that some of our colleagues in the Soviet era were sampling all kinds of stuff that we probably wouldn't have sampled so much as the first line of defense in looking at contamination of a lead smelter in the U.S. They also, one of the things I haven't mentioned before, is they also were looking at dietary supplements. They were actually looking at feeding algae supplements to help chelate some of the metals out of the human body. They did a lot of research in that area in the Soviet Union. They didn't, though, have data or sample things like air stack emissions, lead levels in workers, or residents. Because in the Soviet era, if a company was owned by the government, it was automatically in compliance. It didn't really have anything to do with data, so it was in your best interest not to collect data that might suggest otherwise. It was just in compliance by virtue of being owned by the government. But again, they did a lot of really interesting stuff. This slide, which I'm not going to go into the details of, but I want to just show it to you because they did a lot of empirical data analysis over about a 20 to 25 year period to try to predict how long it would take for natural cycles to clean the site if the smelter were just to shut down. How long would it take just natural processes of erosion and dilution, really, and bringing in new windblown dust to make this place relatively safe? And when you think about it, heavy metals, that's really all that would happen naturally. Lead is going to be lead forever. It's on the periodic chart, so it's not going to break down to anything less hazardous. And they concluded that just looking at natural biogeochemical cycles, it would take thousands of years for this place to become safe. So as a result of that, there was a decision in the 80s to relocate residents, to just move the town, build a new smelter, demolish it, rebuild it, provide dietary supplements to the residents. And they actually had planned to do this. This was actually a cleanup plan while the Soviet Union was still functional. And then, in 1989, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, that plan was shelved and nothing had happened since. So when we went there in the mid-90s, it was just sort of in this limbo of, well, yeah, we had all these plans, but now there's no money, there's no, you know, the government is all broken apart, nothing's going to happen, and here we are with this sort of limping along old smelter and knowing about all these problems, but really with no solutions. Interestingly, at Bunker Hill, under Superfund, you're required to evaluate the no-action alternative. That is, what would happen if you did nothing? You know, how many people would get sick? How bad would the environment be polluted? How long would it take for natural biogeochemical cycles to fix this place? And at Bunker Hill, that was done with a you know, probably lots of consultant dollars and sophisticated computer models, and they actually came up with a prediction of it would take 944 years plus or minus 1,000 years. So pretty similar to what the Soviets came up with their empirical models of, you know, it'll take a couple of thousand years to clean it up, which in the U.S. then translated into, therefore, we have to clean it up because we can't wait that long. And in the U.S., relocating towns has been done, I think, only once at Times Beach, Missouri, and the government decided they would never do that again. So that really isn't an option in our system. I mentioned that at Bunker Hill, we learned from many, many years of studies and lots of models that between 80 to 90% of the lead in children's blood comes from soils and dust, and that's been the focus of the cleanup. But that's only at Bunker Hill, and that is what we know to be the case in a lot of U.S. sites like this, because again, the drinking water, the market basket, the local produce, those kinds of things are not big issues. Lead paint, of course, is a big issue at some sites. But our challenge now at Rudnaya-Pristin is to say, what does this flow chart look like in the Russian Far East? Probably doesn't look like this. We don't know. The models that we've done, and I know some of you have worked on the IUBK model, the integrated exposure uptake biokinetic lead model that we use to predict ambient levels in the environment, what does that mean to blood lead? And I think you used the lead spread program to simulate some of those things. So what we wanted to know was, what does this pathway look like in Rudnaya-Pristin? Well, kids in Rudnaya-Pristin also play in the dirt. Two-year-olds also eat dirt. We don't know if they eat more or less dirt, but let's assume that they're also averaging 100 milligrams a day. It's kind of funny when you're sampling surface soils, there's always kids nearby because they always figure you're just playing in the dirt because that's what it looks like. That's what this little guy's doing. Produce is the biggie. In this part of Russia, it is estimated that 50% of the caloric intake is from potatoes that are grown in the kitchen gardens. It's probably not true anywhere in the United States that I can think of, certainly not in Idaho. So these little gardens that we're sampling that are literally right across the street from the smelter are subsistence gardens. They are not optional gardens like they were at Bunker Hill. So the food pathway becomes really, really dominant. And we don't know, there hasn't been enough research done, even using the UBK model, to really try to make good predictions about uptake in different kinds of plants. You know, we know some plants take materials up through their roots. Sometimes you're looking more at the air pollution that falls on the leaves and how well you wash the leaves or how you cook the food. Whether you're eating the potato skin or not, you know, all of those factors become really critical to understanding the diet pathway. And we think from preliminary studies that the diet pathway at Rudnaya-Pristin and sites like this is extremely important to look at. And we can't just say, it's maybe 10%, let's not worry about it. It might be as high as 50%. We really don't know the answer to that yet. And understanding that pathway is going to be key to figuring out the appropriate remedy and cleanup. Drinking water, there is some municipal water. There are a lot of local wells like this one. It's pretty clean at this particular site. Fortunately, there's not a lot of groundwater contamination. But there's a lot of contaminants in soils. You can see here garden levels in the thousands, you know, 4,000. For the yards and gardens, roadsides, 22,000. The railroad, I showed you where the concentrates are spilled, the maximum 95,000. Along the beaches, there's some transport by ships. Along the riverbanks, actually not as high as we might have predicted from the tailings. But we know that soil levels are significant and that that's always a significant pathway. The Blacksmith Institute provided some initial funding to this site last year to a non-governmental organization, a local nonprofit called the Far East Health Fund, which was started by a former graduate student of mine, Peter Sharoff, who studied here at the University of Idaho and did a lot of work around the Bunker Hill site to try to figure out how to take the appropriate remedies to a place like Rudnaya Pristina and make them work and make them affordable. And he just completed his PhD degree with Dr. Nadezhda Christoforova, the lady that I showed you in that first picture. So it's kind of come full circle. He came here for his master's degree, he went back to Vladivostok, got his PhD, and his dissertation was about the cleanup plan at Rudnaya Pristina with some of the seed money that he got from the Blacksmith Institute. And with some of that seed money, he was able to do the first blood lead level sampling of area children. And he found levels, as you can see here, the range was from 1.6 to 56.7 micrograms per deciliter with an average of about 12.4. Now with blood lead levels, we really, you know, we might say, well, the average doesn't look that much above 10, but we're really concerned about the kids above those levels. So isolating the children who are getting significant amounts of lead exposure. He also is starting to do quite a bit of work now on this problem with the potatoes. You know, they're grown in contaminated soil. How are they prepared? They're a huge part of the caloric intake. Are they a source of lead pollution? Or are there other garden vegetables that might be more significant? And he's been working with a lot of the public schools and local health centers on educational programs about living in communities that are heavily contaminated like this one. And this is a picture of him. This is Peter Sharoff. He also, just this fall, ran as a candidate in one of the first green parties in Vladivostok, which I think is just, I haven't grown up in the Cold War. I think it's wonderful that there are now green parties in Russia. He lost big time, but there's still a green party in Russia, and he ran, which I think is pretty wonderful. So what we're working on now is really trying to figure out how do we identify the most critical pathways, food, soil, you know, the likely culprits right now. The smelter is now shut down, so air pollution in itself is not as big a source except from windblown dust. Will the smelter be modernized or will it be demolished? Can we revegetate some of the areas where the exposed bad soils are, you know, so accessible to kids? And really importantly, can we provide some kind of a stable socioeconomic condition for this community? I mentioned the lead smelter was the main employer in town. It's now closed. And in remote parts of Russia like this, people really don't have the ability to just move. They don't just go to places where jobs are better very easily. So the whole idea of stabilizing the community around the cleanup is really a critical part of making the cleanup be successful. When you think about the options for severing the pathways, maybe I'll just shut up for a minute. Let you just think about potatoes. If you lived in an isolated place like this in Russia, and 50% of your diet was potatoes that you grew in your backyard, and let's say the government came along and said, boy, we have a cleanup plan for how to keep you from eating this contaminated food. Maybe that cleanup plan would be, you know, we're going to bring you potatoes from the outside. I suspect your reaction might be, yeah, but what if that truck doesn't show up? You know, if I'm in the middle of winter in Russia, I want to make sure I have something to eat. I'm probably going to still plant stuff in my garden. And if I don't end up eating it, I'm probably going to sell it. So providing outside sources of food with some reliability would probably be highly suspect in this part of the world. Even though it might seem, you know, like a pretty easy fix. In the U.S., if we have contaminated water supplies, we bring in trucks of water and, you know, let people drink clean water until we fix the problem. Clearly, removing and replacing the soil with clean soil and providing clean gardens is an option that we definitely want to find the funding to do. It's not a cheap, easy thing to do, but you can use local labor. I mean, it's not technologically difficult. You got to get buy-in to let people let you dig up their yards that they've been protecting for 50 years, and that takes a lot of communication. But it's something that I think is doable and is part of the community education plan. So replacing the soils, definitely an option. You know, even at Bunker Hill, there was talk about, well, wouldn't it be cheaper just to move everybody out of here? Yeah, it might have been cheaper, but it wouldn't have happened. In Russia, that might be an option that they consider because people don't appear to be quite as adverse to it. They're more used to it. whether that's right or wrong, it might be an option that they would consider in part of their cleanup strategy that we maybe would write off much more quickly in the U.S. So there are all those kinds of things that you need to think about in terms of, you know, what are the things we did at Bunker Hill that would work here, that you could afford to do here, that makes sense and that could be maintained. So now we're going to jump over to Southern Africa, to Zambia. And this is a site that I just visited a couple of years ago. It's an abandoned lead smelter. So it's been abandoned for about 10 years. It potentially affects hundreds of thousands of people through both mining and smelting and the abandoned contaminants that are left in place. And there are some early things happening in terms of cleanup actions that I'll describe to you. This has been a pretty famous place in the lead world. We suspect that there may have been incidents or accidents that created some really horrific conditions, because there were reports of children dying at this facility from severe lead poisoning. And that probably is more likely to happen as a result of some really horrific thing happening than just sort of routine exposures. So there were very, very high lead levels here in years before they were really studied, but there were a lot of varying levels of quality reports coming from this site for a couple of decades that caused this to be on people's lists of concern, and it is one of the ones on the top 10 list. There have been some lead levels tested for some of the area children for some periods of time, not nearly as comprehensive as those tests need to be. It's an area that the population here is living really as, in many ways, as scavengers around an old industrial facility that's been abandoned. And you can see from the buildings in the back of this picture, the housing is built from local soils. So people are literally living in houses that are made from contaminated materials. Now, there's a pathway that you probably wouldn't find in the U.S. So if you look at the UBK model and you say, well, how would you translate that into what it means in terms of blood lead levels? We probably really don't know, because we haven't studied places like this very much. This facility was owned by Anglo-American Copper Company, and then it became nationalized, owned by the Zambian government, and then they had joint ownership before it was closed and abandoned about 10 years ago. One of the few visible signs of cleanup activity that you can see there, you can maybe read what's written with rocks on the side of the tailings pile. It says, keep the environment clean. And then all around it, there's just pretty horrendous pollution. The area has tens of thousands of people live around this abandoned facility, and they are served by two nurses. There's a small health center, and if you think about what is going on in that health center, probably most of what they're dealing with is AIDS, malaria, cholera, broken bones, childbirth, and then maybe way down on the list, lead poisoning. So lead poisoning is probably not the most critical health concern to this community. But one way that I look at it is, if you can use issues like lead pollution and you can mobilize dollars to provide health care to a community in such dire need of health care, then that's a good thing. Who cares what you're really addressing? You're addressing the health of this community, and by providing better health care, it raises the boat for everybody. One day that we were there, we saw these kids headed up towards the abandoned smelter on this little trail, and we asked them what they were doing. Well, they were going fishing. So this might be a pathway of concern at this particular site. Kids are, the access to the abandoned facility is completely open. People were walking all around it, playing all around it. The town of Kabwe is deserted. It's a ghost town. There is no employment in this community. And these young men are actually making a living scavenging materials from the smelter and selling it. And they actually make a pretty good living, but it's an incredibly dangerous job, not only from the exposure to contaminants, but the fact that they are using pickaxes to basically dig little tunnels, and these tunnels collapse, and several people every few months die from this activity. Well, in terms of opportunities, to leave on a little bit more positive note, we met this young man, Peter Sinkamba, in Kabwe, and he was educated as a mining engineer, planned to go work in the mines, and then decided to become an environmental activist. And he started a non-governmental organization to try to deal with exactly these kinds of problems. And so Blacksmith is looking at funding either his or another local environmental agency that, again, tries to bring the grassroots community involvement into the cleanup project. And when we met with Peter Sinkamba in Kabwe, it was quite interesting to me that he had been, the miracle of the internet, he had been accessing other nonprofits around the world who had been dealing with similar problems with lead pollution. He'd read about the Bunker Hill site. He'd read about another site in Dallas that we worked on, a secondary lead smelter. He knew stuff about how he needed to be able to mobilize resources locally to get a cleanup effected. And that in itself is, I think, a really important sign of the changes happening in the world now. People in his position, even a decade ago, would never have had that kind of access to information, to knowledge, and to money that they have nowadays. And that is an incredibly powerful tool when we think about how we want to address international environmental health issues. The network that we can create among people like him is really astounding. There's another NGO, CURF, that is already providing some educational services with a little bit of seed money. And the World Bank has actually mobilized some resources to this site. They've provided a $20 million grant to do some scoping and to start some cleanup activities next year. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because the consultants that the World Bank hired are some of the same folks who have worked on the industry side of cleanup, arguing that soil remediations are really not necessary. So it'll be interesting to see how that cleanup project plays out in terms of lessons that we've learned at Bunker Hill and the great successes that we've seen in reducing blood leads by doing environmental remediation and feeling very convinced that it is necessary. Whether they decide to put the money more into education or into relocation or into remediation remains to be seen. So back to kind of the lessons learned from Bunker Hill, and how do we translate it to places like Rudnaya and Kabwe. The risk-based cleanup, critical. You need to understand the pathways. You need to understand the health problems in order to come up with the right kind of remedies. They take a long time. These kind of cleanups do not happen overnight. It takes a long time to get to the root of the problem and to figure out how to mobilize the resources locally and regionally and nationally to the cleanup. I mentioned, that it takes a lot of money and that we don't have that in most other places in the world. And even in the U.S., where we've spent all this money and we're looking at pollutants like lead that we've known have been bad for a very long time, there's still a lot of fundamental research going on things like IQ deficit associated with low level of lead exposure to the death of swans. Swans eat dirt too, like little kids, and swans die sometimes on their migration paths far from where they actually got the source of the contamination. People looking at snail parasites and lead levels. I mean, there's all kinds of fundamental research that goes into understanding these sites well beyond the human health impacts. We know, when we look globally then, that there are really different sources and quantities of capital, and that's first and foremost. You don't have as much money to throw at a problem. You need to make it work for the local area that you're in and within their financial system and within their legal system. It's also interesting to learn about the level of public interest, and I have interest here in quotes, because in different parts of the world there are very different perception of the rights that people have in terms of damages to their health from the environment. In Russia, for example, when we would explain how environmental actions are part of really the political process, how a politician stands on an environmental issue or whether money will come to a local area can be manipulated and proffered by the local politicians, is really part of our system. And in Russia, we would try to explain that, and they'd look at us and say, well, yeah, but how did you get your government to spend any money on that? And we'd sort of try to explain it again, and it was a complete disconnect. I mean, that is has been so foreign to the way governments have worked in Russia, that the idea that the government would all of a sudden come forward and provide resources to help with a local human health issue was just, you know, just something they couldn't even conceive of happening. And so it says in the Russian Constitution that you have a right to a clean environment, that you have rights to protect your health, but those kinds of rights have not played out in the same litigious way that they have in the United States, for example. I'm convinced that people have universal concerns for health. I mean, everybody wants their kids to be healthy. You know, I don't think that is anything that really changes across borders. But their perception of what they can do to change that is really variable. In some places we see a lot of activism. In some places we feel hopelessness. You know, people just figure this is the way it's always been. It's never going to change. We just have to get used to it. But it's usually not really apathy. I think the concern is pretty universal. And so we really need to work with local experts and develop local expertise to try to work through a lot of those systems. So the fact that we've, you know, just within 10 years had a young student from Vladivostok come and study here and go back and run as a Green Party member and work on a local cleanup in Russia, I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing to see, you know, in less than one generation. And those are the kinds of changes that I see really happening around the world. We need to figure out how to get that expertise to be locally appropriate and make sense locally in terms of levels of technology and maintenance and those kinds of things. The science needs, I think I've dwelled on these quite a bit already. You know, clearly we got to have good data. We've got to understand the transport of contaminants, the pathways, and then figure out all the ways to sever those exposure pathways. And those are clear. Those are lessons learned that we can translate conceptually our understanding, but to make them actually work on the ground requires a lot more than science. It requires understanding political systems, legal systems, economic systems, social systems, all of those kinds of perceptions that I just talked about. Let's see, I think I just didn't hit the button. So, I'll just stand kind of on my pulpit for a few more minutes and just talk about what I think is the role of the developed world in attacking these problems. And it really is the role of the developed world because quite frankly, in my opinion, it's the developed world that often caused these problems, and so I think we have a real obligation to deal with these problems in a logical way. Most of the world, of course, doesn't have influence politically or any other way on regulating their environment and their quality of life. They are really victims of it. They don't have influence. That doesn't mean they don't have concerns, and that doesn't mean that they don't care about health. It just means they don't have the influence on the regulation that we do. This is a graph that you may have seen before, but I think it's worth revisiting. This was actually developed back in the early 90s. The UN Human Development Report provided this inverted or this champagne glass view of the world that basically shows that about 20% of the people on the planet control 85% of the world's wealth. And that is not not separable from environmental health issues, human justice issues, a lot of the kinds of issues that I've described to you in the sites that we've talked about on the top 10 list. It's really the developed world in their use of raw material in energies and in food supplies that have affected a lot of these problems, and therefore I think really need to be a part of changing that balance. The trends that we've seen in our lifetimes in a country like Zambia, for example, or in other parts of Africa, where you see the collapse of colonialism and the onslaught, the beginnings of industrialization, and multinational corporations moving into countries where the legal systems are much weaker, the political systems are much weaker in terms of people being able to effectively protect their health from environmental disasters. These are big trends around the world that we need to figure out how to address from, you know, the developed world view and the accesses that we have to information and to funds. It involves a lot of people, and it involves keeping your eyes open and your minds open and your hearts open to the serendipity that can happen in connecting all of the players. The local communities really, I think, are first on this list, but universities, NGOs, legal systems, health people, science people, all of those people have to come together to try to make sure that environmental health issues are addressed in the kind of priorities that we wish we understood better and in the logical and fair manner that they need to be. I think in terms of looking at international environmental issues and international corporate behavior, we really have to be pretty humbled by how much is really possible, and don't underestimate what is possible. It requires, in a sense, continual pressure from governments, from scientists, from legal systems, from local nonprofits and communities that help regulate corporate behavior in terms of their actions when they go to other parts of the world, like Zambia, and do things that they wouldn't be allowed to get away with in other parts of the world. And regulating that corporate behavior is really a big part of making sure that we address the international environmental health issues that we've observed. So I hope you've enjoyed this lecture today. And I really wish that, as a result of this, you're inspired to do as much international travel as you can and to try to take the many lessons that you've had in this environmental toxicology class and think about what they mean in other parts of the world, because the challenges are huge, but the opportunities to do good things are even bigger. And I wish you luck, and thank you for listening today. Thank you, Greg.
And thank you very much, Margaret. Appreciate it so much. Thank you for the microphone.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Well, we've come to the end of the 2006 Socrates lecture. Thank you once again, Margaret. That was an excellent lecture. We do appreciate that. I couldn't help but noticing the linkage that you talked about in terms of Cold War, World War II bullets in Rudnaya. The bullets for the United States in World War II actually came from Bunker Hill. But what that helps us do is establish the connections, that the connections that we have with our environment isn't necessarily just with our local environment, but in fact with the global environment. As your futures develop, you will find that these connections are more important to you in your life and as well the health of the global environment. What we do on a personal basis, our own behaviors, our own consumption practices, our own commitment to concepts such as sustainability and minimizing our impact on the planet will in fact have the potential to build as populations grow and develop and we change our behaviors, perhaps making the future better than the past. With that, thank you much for your attention. Next time we'll revisit the series of lectures here to conclude the course, Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Thank you so much.